Okay, today's October 24th, 5772, and we're starting with Mitzvah 188, the prohibition of pleasure with any woman ranked as an erava. So for the next several sessions, we're going to be looking at these prohibitions till the end of this parsha. Acharei Mot is basically, I think with one exception, all prohibitions on uncovering ervas of different people. So what is erva? That's a good question. Let's start with that. Erva means nakedness. And it refers to any part of the body that's usually covered. So we have a concept in halacha that tefach ba'isha erva. So a tefach is one hand's breadth. It's a measurement. It's a hand's breadth. It's a man's hand's breadth. So usually, and men have different size hands also, right? So an amah, I'm sure, are you aware of an amah? We talk about our own dalad amot. Often, dalad amos, right, our own surroundings. An amah is from here, from our elbow to our hand, to the top of our hand. This is an amah. So that's generally held to be about 18 inches. And a hand's breadth is usually about 4 inches. But it's not an exact measurement. It's the measurement of a man's hand. Okay, so that's a tefach. So why do we need that? Tefach ha-be'isha erva. Because there are certain halachic things that a man can't do in the presence of erva. So a man is not allowed to learn Torah or make a bracha in the presence of erva. So if that's the case, then we have to be able to define what erva is. So the minimum definition is a tefach of what's usually covered on a woman. So I think it depends on, there's objective and subjective standards. So in a society where women are more covered, then one tefach showing of the more coveredness would be erva that he wouldn't be permitted to daven or learn in front of. In today's society, hair is considered erva, hair of a married woman. However, in today's society, since so many married women do not cover their hair, in general, men are permitted to pray and learn in front of a married woman's uncovered hair. Mm-hmm. However, there are a few who are stringent and won't even make a bracha, you know, a bori pri ha'etz. And I mean, they'll just close their eyes to make the bracha because they won't make it in front of a married woman's uncovered hair. So, and then there's other parts of the body too. So we measure that tefach. So today, in our general milieu, we measure that tefach, let's say, from our elbow. So that in general, our practice in Sneas today is to cover our elbows. Really, our arm only has to be covered to here, right above, right exactly our elbow. But since when we raise our hand, our sleeve goes up and a whole tefach might show, our practice is to cover below our elbow so that our elbow is never exposed. So, and the same with other parts too, chest and knees, and so a tefach is considered. And that tefach has moved into some controversy in hair covering as well. So if we have the rule, tefach ba'isha erva, in the more modern circles, where women show some of their hair, cover their hair, but show. So there is a misunderstanding that it's permitted to show a tefach. So many women will measure a tefach. So they cover with the hat in the front, and they will show some in the back. Let's say a short haircut with some showing the back. That's a common thing. Or they cover with a tichel around, but they show some either bangs, or their hair, it slides
or
back
it just
a little
slides,
bit.
Yeah.
Or it slides, yeah. But they allow it to slide because it looks prettier.
Oh, okay.
Right? Or a snood with some showing. Mm-hmm. Right? So some people measure how much is showing a tefach. Mm-hmm. So some people, and there's even controversy within this, but my understanding is that this is a misunderstanding. But even within that misunderstanding, there's controversy. How much is a tefach? Mm-hmm. Is a tefach this much that you could show that much of your hair, could slide back to here, and it's okay? Mm-hmm. Or is the tefach split in half to the two sides of your head so that you can only show two fingers in the front so it can slide back that far? Okay,
oh,
that's the controversy.
but again, this is the man's hand, right?
A man's hand, right, right. Yeah. So you could, so according to those arguments, and you will see in modern circles that quite a bit of hair is showing, mm-hmm. some more and some less, mm-hmm. depending on how they hold on the tefach issue.
How large is the tefach?
Approximately four inches. Approximately. But it's not an exact measure because it's a man's hand breadth. Now, that being said, really, the halacha is not that a tefach is permissible, that it's up to a tefach before a man cannot make a bracha or learn Torah in front of it. So because you have to have a halachic shir, where is the line drawn before you can't do something that's kadosh in front of that amount of erva anymore? So it's not that it's allowed, it's that still with something showing, he could still make that bracha. So that's the difference there. So in modern circles, some people think it's permitted, whereas in fact it's just that still with that showing, one could make a bracha. But it's not that it's permitted to show, it's lechatchila from the outset, it's that bedieved, if it is showing, then he still could make a bracha. So it's a bedieved situation, means post facto, rather than a lechatchila, from a preferable situation. Okay, that being said, erva in this case is a bigger word, which means any woman that you're not allowed to have sex with. So here it's the prohibition of pleasure with any woman ranked as an erva. So when it says, don't uncover the erva of all these categories that we're going to look at, it's uncovering the erva. So we'll see what it looks like inside. But the erva means anybody you're not allowed to have sex with, in this larger sense of the word erva. In the smaller sense of the word erva, it means that a part of a person that should be covered, or generally is covered, even somebody who's permitted, even one's wife, right? And some people hold, and then of course, since it's a halachic measurement, you have to know who does it apply to. So some people hold from age 3, a girl from age 3, has to be covered to a certain extent. Now, there's all kinds of room, let's say between 3-year-olds and approximately 6, 7, 8-year-olds, when a girl really looks like a girl all the time. That's when everybody agrees that she has to be covered. When she for sure looks like a girl, that you could, even if she would have a short haircut and she, you know, like a boy, but you could tell she's a girl. That's when all these laws for sure fall on her. But many say from age 3. So in general, in our circles, we're careful from age 3, certainly for synagogue attendance, which is where men are praying and learning regularly. I don't think that in most homes a father would be careful to not pray or learn in front of his own daughter, who's wearing, you know, a 3-year-old girl who's wearing a sleeveless dress or, you know, or something short, or does a cartwheel or whatever. You know, I don't think that's a problem. But in shul, we are more careful to cover girls up more. And then each family, according to their own custom, between 3 and whatever that age is, 6, 7, 8, you know, however they do it. So some people allow girls to have shorter sleeves or wear pants or whatever it is, and some people are careful from age 3. Okay, anyway, so here we go with Mitzvah 188, not to have pleasure with any one of the maritally forbidden women who are consanguineous relations, a married woman, and one defiled by the menses. I don't like that English translation, but whatever. A woman that one is married to, and this even without conjugal intimacy. So this is not saying, this prohibition is not about sex with these women. It's about uncovering their nakedness, so seeing them naked, outside, of course, of a professional capacity. What is that noise? Somebody, sounds like music in here, right?
I can hear the background.
Yeah, I can hear the music, yeah. Huh, okay. All right, try to ignore that. Anyway, so it's uncovering their nakedness, and then also he's extending it to doing anything that gives you pleasure that's not sex. For example, embracing, kissing, or anything similar, as he says, to these evil actions. Mm-hmm. In which lechers engross themselves, who go after vapidity and become worthless. Okay, so what is this? So this is saying, so obviously kissing and hugging is not evil, but it is evil if you're doing it to get some kind of sexual pleasure from somebody that you're not allowed to have sex with.
Yeah, that could have been explained maybe a hair dab better for us today.
Well, for us today. So, okay, so this is actually a long one, yeah, we're going to see. And so remember that he's writing to his bar mitzvah boy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But let's just start with Rav Hirsch a little bit, because that's very helpful, his explanation. And it's pretty long. I probably should have copied it for you. But, okay.
Here is this one.
This is in Rav Hirsch, Rav Hirsch's commentary to the Torah in Vayikra 18, starting with the verse 6. It's a nice long essay. There's a lot that he writes about sexuality, but just in this essay, he's writing about this group of halachas that we're going to see over the next couple of weeks. So he says, although this whole chapter is taken from the standpoint of the man, the prohibition is directed equally to both sexes, and both are punishable in exactly the same degree. So even though everything that we're saying is don't uncover the erva of a woman, that it's all, you can flip it all too. So and the punishment is exactly the same. So what he's talking about, so the term for all forbidden sexual acts is called gilui arayot. So an araya is a person that you're not allowed to have sex with, or an act that you're not allowed to engage in. And gilui means revelation of. So gilui arayot, that's what forbidden sexual acts are called, that as a whole group. And those are our three cardinal sins that we have to die rather than transgress, our idol worship, right, or avodah zarah, it's not idol worship, but any foreign worship that's not Jewish worship, murder, and gilui arayot. So this is one of the foundational principles of Judaism, and we have to see why. So we've spent a lot of time in this class, or at least I have in many, many incarnations of my teaching, talking about the kedusha of the sexual relationship. But as holy as it is, it's that negative also done improperly. And so that's what all this is about, is the depths of the negativity. And you have to see that it's exactly the opposite. So as much kedusha as it can bring into the world, which it can, channel the Shekhinah into the world and absolutely bring shalom because of the wholeness and completion inside marriage, where two parts are melded into one and emulating Hashem and Hashem's oneness, the height that that can accomplish, it can accomplish the exact same depth. So that's what all this is about, is the depth. So how do you accomplish those depths? How do you go? It doesn't take much. Because all it takes is becoming just physical about it. Right? Once you're just physical about it, then what is it? So even a married couple who's permitted to each other, but let's just pick a younger married couple, let's say going to, which they shouldn't, a drive-in movie or whatever, having sex in a car. That's just physical. It's just satisfying both of their physical urges. It's not about bonding. It's not about creating a relationship. It's just we're allowed, so let's do it, and it's fun. That's not kedusha. That's not what we're after in Jewish sexuality. What we're after is the bonding, the creation of a relationship that's holy, strong, and pure, which can for sure involve passion and pleasure, and should, but not just. And if it ever sinks to a just, then it's empty and plain old physicality. It's just like animals in the field.
Well, isn't it, though, to take some of the onus off and the guilt off the woman, isn't the real, the bad thing is the spilling of the seed?
No, it's that's a separate isur.
Oh, okay.
The separate Easter spilling of the seed.
But no. In this case, isn't that also part of this, or no?
That's not even being discussed here,
okay.
Really.
Okay.
It's about what relations can you have and can't you have. So let's say you're not spilling your seed. You're having sex with somebody who's going to get pregnant from your seed. Mm-hmm. That's not a spilling. And you're totally not allowed to have sex with your sister, with your mother, with your mother's mother, with your sister's, with your sister's daughter, with your brother's daughter. There's all kinds of family relationships that you're not allowed to have sex with.
So these are prohibited
forever. Now, many of these relationships are so close that you're permitted some kind of contact because you don't even suspect physical, you don't even suspect sexuality. So for instance, a son can always hug his mother and his grandmother and his great-grandmother, all the mothers straight back. He can never marry them and he can never have sex with them. He can always hug them.
Can he hug his mother-in-law?
No.
not even.
I know, it's so hard. It's very uncomfortable, I have to say. It's very difficult. So mother-in-law, no.
And sister-in-law?
Mm-mm, no contact. So your mother's straight back and your daughter's straight down, you can hug or touch or whatever, right, in a non-sexual way. But the in-laws, nope, there's no contact permitted at all.
Wow. And yeah. Same with the daughter. The daughter can't hug the father-in-law.
Correct.
Or the uncles or the brother-in-laws or any of that.
Correct. Correct. Now, again, that's generally what's, I mean, certainly when we see in the halacha here in Sefer Chinuch, it says, not allowed to do anything that gives you pleasure, for example, embracing, kissing, or anything similar to these evil actions, meaning getting sex. Why are they evil actions? Because you're getting sexual pleasure from that embrace, from that touch, and we'll see even more that it even goes further than that. So pleasure really is one of the things. So derech chiba, affectionate or pleasure gaining touch is absolutely forbidden. Now let's go to a place where it's not affectionate or pleasure gaining, just in terms of the halacha today. So there is a question. So there's a question, for instance, about handshaking.
Right.
Or possibly even, and this is not in the Haredi world, so I'm speaking outside the Haredi world, but in the more modern but still halachically observant world, possibly even social cheek kissing. Because there is, it seems to be, and I don't know the source for this, but I have heard, so I can't promise that it's the case, but I have heard, that Rashi, who lived in France, where the hand kiss was the common gentlemanly thing to do upon greeting a woman, had nothing to do with sexuality, it was just the way, right, similar to our cheek kissing today, that...
Or even a hug today is very common for a greeting.
It is very common. So... The hand kissing, apparently, Rashi felt, according to what I've heard and have not seen inside, was acceptable as a form of greeting in a non-affectionate way at all. So if it would be somebody, and I guess somebody who would permit himself that would have to be very honest with his own feelings if he, you know, liked that person or not, if it was just a formality or not, which could get tricky. In general, in our circles today, we don't touch it at all, in the Haredi circles. Now, when I first started working for Jewish Experience, the way that I hold halachically, personally, and this is personally, everybody has to check with their own rabbi, is I never extend my hand, or I try not to extend my hand, but if somebody extends their hand to me, I take it and shake their hand, a male's hand. So that was my policy, and that's how I learned that in this society, it's not derech chiba to shake a hand. I don't do the social kissing, but to shake a hand, I would shake a hand if extended to me. I didn't extend it to them. When I started working for Jewish Experience, I felt I'm representing Jewish Experience. I need to ask the bosses there how they want me to represent that organization. It's not just about me. So I asked Rabbi Junior Wasserman, who is my boss, what to do, because I knew that he did not. Even if somebody would extend his hand, her hand to him, he did not take it. But I had seen Rabbi Senior Wasserman, who does take a hand if it's extended to him. So I asked Rabbi Junior Wasserman, what should I do? He said, I'll ask my father and get back to you. And he never got back to me. And that was the answer. He couldn't answer. That was the answer. That he's not answering. So he can't. How can I assume that? Yes, but that was the answer.
That it's your decision?
That I was holding in a halachic place, and so that halachic place had to...
But he didn't want to just come and say it's okay.
Right. So he did not want to condone.
Right.
Right. He did not want to condone, and he did not want to forbid.
Prohibit.
Right. 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 Right.
So then what do you do then?
So I still take a hand if it's extended to me, but I don't extend my hand. That's my policy. Come on, this is supposed to turn off when I do this. Go away.
That is, it's a very awkward thing today.
It's extremely awkward.
It causes embarrassment to some. It's, you know, you're living in a secular world.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Right. Yes.
And I do exactly.
You do feel, you do make people feel bad. Yeah,
right.
Know,
it's
know.
Very hard to.
Yeah. So I normally do the same thing.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Meanwhile, I told my sister for her wedding, she was marrying a Catholic guy, a guy of Catholic origin, not no longer practicing Catholic, but because of Catholic origin, large family, many brothers. Mexican, so huggy also type. So I said, you know, can you please tell your groom and his brothers that I don't shake hands with men? I don't want to be all over that wedding, you know. Like, no problem. She's going to tell them. So great. Get to the wedding thinking the whole thing is set, right? And her groom comes over to me and puts his arm around my shoulders and says, don't worry, I told all my brothers you don't shake hands with men. I'm like, oh. I totally forgot that shake hands is our code word for not touch. I meant not touch. I don't touch. And of course you could see somebody else that thinks that's just a weird Jewish thing. You don't shake hands, but you hug. Shaking hands is like some kind of symbol of something, so you don't do that.
Hugging's okay.
Right. Yeah, so anyway, so you're not supposed to do that with any type of affection, because you don't want to. So that's the thing, is that the union, the sexual union, is supposed to create a unity that's so powerful that you can't risk that creation in any type of a negative way with somebody that you shouldn't. So what's with all these people who are so close to you, all the relationships that we're going to look at? So what Rav Hirsch explains is that, and it's interesting that he explains it this way. He says, first of all, he does not understand this. It's too big, and he's not going to attempt to explain it. However, that being said, he has some thought and some insight that he'll share without touching the core of it. So the some thought and some insight that he shares is, first of all, that a farmer certainly doesn't plant seeds willy-nilly, would be careful about the seeds that he plants where and how, and certainly human beings should be careful with their seeds, where and how they're planted, and certainly even more so the Jews, and even more so the Kohanim. He says as you get into a different level, this circle where you can plant seeds is more narrower and narrower. So that's about planting seeds and creating fruit. So that's number one, is with whom does one want to create fruit, and what should that fruit look like? So we know clearly, and which we'll see inside the Sefer Chinuch also, that the fruit of close physically close relationships is not a healthy fruit, right? So first cousins and anything closer than that, brothers and sisters, mothers and sons, do not produce healthy fruit. So that is one. So is that unhealthy fruit because it's an unhealthy relationship? Or is the relationship because the fruit's unhealthy? They're not going into that. We do have a principle that we know, certainly from Rabbi Tatz, but I'm sure from further than that, that the Torah is causative, not responsive. So it wouldn't be the way that we would explain it, to say because the offspring is unhealthy, so the relationship is forbidden. That's not our, we would say the opposite. The relationship's forbidden, and therefore the offspring is unhealthy. But what Rav Hirsch is saying is that in terms of creating a Jewish nation, we have to be very careful. So let's see. This establishes the fact that for the correct estimation of these chukim and mishpatim, which regulate the whole of Jewish individual, private, as well as social public life, they are nothing exceptional, nothing calculated for supermen or out of the ordinary. They are just meant, starting with the Jewish family of mankind, to ensure that the stage of human life shall be regained, which was the original purpose, right? So that the world was destroyed with the flood because people had sex with whoever they wanted to. And now humanity has to be regulated better so that what still remains the purpose, I have problems tracking here, of a race of beings, humanity created in the likeness of God and to guide the whole human race up to such a level, which is the meaning of God's direction of the whole world in history, has to be created in a certain with more holiness. That is why the whole summary of all the happiness which is to blossom and mature from these chukim and mishpatim is crystallized into words, v'chai behem, you should live in them. Nothing more and nothing less is to be won from their observance than chai, than life, and that highest conception of having positively and truly lived. Okay, so that's the purpose of the laws, and here it's saying to be a priestly nation and a holy people in the midst of and for the salvation of mankind, which had gone astray, the father of mankind drew the borders for the choice of mates still narrower for this people, and then for the priests of this priestly nation, we find them drawn yet narrower still. To obtain nobler and higher species of plants and animals, human gardeners and breeders do not leave the planting of the seeds for the production of the desired objects just to chance, and do not allow any and every kind of seed to mix or to be planted in every condition or time. To obtain the noblest blossom out of material matter, to obtain earthly creatures in the likeness of God, to obtain man, can it be superfluous to listen to and to obey the directions of the Father and the Teacher of the human generation? Let's see. Okay, so one of the things he talks about, there's so much interesting stuff here. So the sexual union is about creating the kedusha between two disparate parts of humanity. So he says, also within the close relationships, there's already a very close bond. So that if you're just going to add sexuality into that, where there's already a strong love between mother and son, and now you're just going to add sexuality, so the sexuality is not really adding to the bond, and in fact could detract. Because a mother cannot never stop being a mother, and a sister can never stop being a sister, and an aunt can never stop being an aunt. There's a different relationship there, and there's a relationship of respect that's changed with sexuality. A sexual relationship is supposed to be a relationship of peers to each other, although it can also be a relationship of dominance, as we see with rape, and that's part of the concept of rape throughout the world is about dominating and saying you're mine or I conquer you. That should not be the case ever in marriage. So that this power that can be a conquering force should be a force of elevation and sanctity. But it could so easily be a force of conquering. So it can, and so easily can lead to lack of respect rather than increased respect. So certainly not with a mother, a sister, an aunt, or any of those relationships that are forbidden, because it doesn't add to and in fact can detract from the closeness of the relationship. So really the sexual union is supposed to be about the transcendence of the disparateness of the two that it's uniting. So when you have male and female from different families, to get them together, as we all know, is a complete miracle.
True.
Sure thing. Right? Anybody who's been married knows that being married and staying married is a lot of work. I have my mother-in-law and father-in-law just going about to celebrate their 59th anniversary. So they have a sign on their fridge that says the first 50 years are the hardest. So I think now that things are getting harder, she's going to switch it to the first 50 years are the easiest. But the point is, it's not easy to stay married. And the sexual union is something that really helps with that. It is about transcending or about engaging in something that creates unity. So you can't engage in that when you're engaging in that with all these close relationships. It has to be something that is further so that the function actually works. So there's quite, so that's what he says without saying he's not explaining, without explaining what's going on. So there's two things. Without explaining, because he says it's too big to explain, part of the glimpse of what's going on is A, seeds have to be carefully planted to create the fruit that we want to create, and that there's a kedusha involved in planting those seeds, and B, that the transcendence and the holiness of the sexual union doesn't add to those close relationships, it doesn't function in those relationships, and therefore would make it only erva, right? So only, it would make it just physical, and just physical is not a Jewish way to have sex at all. That's an animal way to have sex. So when it's just physical, that's off limits. But when it's a spiritual union of minds, bodies, and hearts, when you're using the bodily union, let's read this paragraph because it's nice. Amongst the factors that raise into the sphere of the holy and sanctifying mitzvahs, the what otherwise would belong as erva to crude animal life, surely must be reckoned as not the least the fact that the bodily union of the sexes at once lays the foundation for the purest, most intimate, strongest spiritual union of the minds and hearts of two beings. It lays the foundation for that blossoming which our marriage blessing celebrates as ahava, achva, shalom, vereyut, and which forms the sublime conjugal love which the song of conjugal love and love of God praises as stronger than death and which all the stormy floods of fate cannot quench. In short, the vidavak beishto, and he shall cleave to his wife, loses all erva sensuality and becomes invested with the highest moral dedication. If it does really effect that wonder of wonders, that vahayu bas lebasar echad, becoming one flesh, on which all true family happiness and national happiness builds itself up. Right, so it's supposed to be that good, that bringing that sanctity in the world, and you can't if it's built on one of those other relationships that you're not permitted to be engaged in. Okay, so with that, let's go back to 188. Okay, so not allowed to approach anyone to uncover their nakedness. And it's important. So he's talking about not just don't have an active intimacy, which can cause a man to uncover nakedness. So it's not just don't have sex with them, you shall not even approach to uncover. So he's saying, what can't you do? You're not allowed to look at them for pleasure. You're not allowed to smell their perfume. You're not allowed to listen to their voice for pleasure. You're not even allowed to look at their colored clothing for pleasure. So that's an interesting thing, because that's, you'd miss this if you didn't think about the cultural context. Today, we have gobs of clothes. So it's not possible, say, for somebody to recognize the clothes of another hanging on a line, right? And we don't do our wash outside. So what this is saying is, let's say a woman has a garment. It's her garment. Every garment then was one of a kind. There was no mass production, right? So she sheared the sheep and carded the wool and wove it and dyed it and whatever she did, right? So clearly that thing hanging on the line belongs to Chedva. Let's say you think Chedva is, you're attracted to Chedva, but you're keeping these halachas, so you would never look at Chedva. But you see her dress on the line and you think, oh, Chedva. By looking at the dress, you're not allowed to do that. Not allowed to even look at her dress off of her hanging on the line, something that you know is hers. Not even permitted at all to look at anything that makes you think anything inappropriate about somebody with whom you cannot have a relationship. It's completely inappropriate. You're not allowed to go anywhere that brings you to a place. Now, we have lots and lots of fences, and that's what this whole thing is. This, it's very long, as you see. It's several pages, like five pages.
So man is so weak that he cannot...
The sexual attraction is so strong.
And that's really what a lot of the 613 mitzvot are about, is really keeping him in line on the derech, that he has so many mitzvot, because he has, his inclination to go off the path is much more stronger than a woman who has less.
Well, so we started out by saying these apply to men and women, the same. So a woman also is not allowed to look at a man's talis hanging on the line and think, oh, shmooly.
You know, but, you know, you're right. But I mean,
it's less common. And we laugh common. When we say yeah. that, because yes. everybody, I mean, we say that tongue in cheek, because all of us know that nobody's looking at a talis hanging on the line thinking, oh, shmooly. Right.
I mean, we're not. You know, a woman's hair, her clothes, her perfume, her gestures, everything, you know, is indicated.
So, but all this applies to women just the same. So if a woman has the nature that she is, and there are women who have that nature who are much more attracted that way, then she has to work very hard too. So, and it says here, there's all kinds of fences. So one of the fences it puts up is that you're not permitted to inquire after the welfare of a man's wife. So you shouldn't see a guy on the street, hey, Sam, how are you doing? And how's Rose? Not allowed. Not allowed. Just how are you doing?
Why?
Because you're not supposed to be asking about his wife. His wife is not your business.
What if she's been ill?
Maybe she died,
right.
And you can go after him.
Right. Oh, no. No, the woman's not talking to Sam at all.
Oh, right.
I'm talking about when Max meets Sam.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
When Reuven meets Shmuel.
A man meeting a man
is not supposed to inquire about
the wife.
Right.
A woman can say.
So today we talk a lot more period. Let's end the sentence right there. Now, we talk a lot more to members of the opposite sex, and we've broken down a lot of these barriers. There's no question about it. So that is... It is a problem, and clearly we can see there's problems in our society. There's marriages that are falling apart, and it's not just because people have started talking to somebody and then they start sleeping with somebody and then the marriage fell apart. It's not just that, although talking does lead to that. I mean, I have a friend who had a handyman in her house, happened to be a Jewish handyman, and her husband, you know, was busy working all day, and the handyman read books that she loved. And they talked about the books, and they talked about the plots, and they eventually started reading the same books so they could talk about the books, and eventually she got divorced, now she's married to the handyman. So talking does, I mean, it does create relationships, which is why you're supposed to talk to your wife. You know, I mean, that's an important part. It's even talks about in the sexual relationship. You should start by talking, right? So talking does start things up. So we should do try to be careful about who we talk to and what we talk about. That being said, we're not careful as a group today. And that being said, our marriages are in bad shape. There's lots of different factors, but some of the factors of our marriages in general across the community not being in as good shape as they should be in is because so many of these barriers are down, and we don't respect what creates a marriage and what destroys a marriage. We just don't even know that stuff, let alone respect it. But what it's saying here is that even asking about somebody else's wife, a man asking about somebody else's wife, it is breaking it down.
But a woman can do that.
A woman's, yeah, so a woman can, for sure. Right. But maybe when you see your friend, you shouldn't necessarily be asking about their husband. Right? So we do today, but it's not necessarily that it's a healthy thing. Right, right. But, I mean, there is a thing with young couples to not get together. Certainly during the first year of marriage, young couples are careful not to invite other young couples over because you haven't even solidified your own marriage. You need to have some other pretty wife sitting across the table from you. You know, and even if she's not pretty, but you start to hear them talking, you're not supposed to compare marriages either, but it's very easy to compare at first. Let's say two young couples, they're still figuring things out 100%, right? Yeah, the first few years of marriage, right? And so one of them will say, yeah, I always rush home to make sure dinner's on the table by the time my husband gets home from kollel, right? Don't you do that too, Chani? And Chani says, well, actually, I have a job and I hardly ever have to. In fact, Shmuley makes dinner most nights. Now Shmuley's thinking, oh, Shoshi has dinner ready every single night, you know, and it can cause real friction in relationships. So a lot of young couples are careful not to invite other young couples, even for a Shabbos meal, but certainly not to be social. But even that could be too social because it can create problems. So that's part of this, is to be careful, not just about not gazing at somebody else's wife, but making sure you're gazing enough at your own, you know, protecting the sanctity of your own relationship. And that protecting the sanctity of your own relationship begins, he's telling his bar mitzvah boy, it begins there. It begins with not fraternizing at 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, so that you know that you're creating a protective cocoon around yourself that you can give all of you to your wife. She's also protected herself from fraternizing and chatting as a single available girl, where she's allowed in a way, but not. So you're allowed to look at, to gaze, to think about in order to find a partner. I only heard about one couple who do this. I'm sure there's more, but I only personally know one. There is a concept that for getting married, you're allowed to talk to, you're allowed to look at, you're allowed to find your mate, right? Then, after you've found your mate, you found him already, or you found her already. You shouldn't really be looking, talking to, gazing, fraternizing till after you're married. So there are some couples who during the period of engagement have very limited contact because they're not permitted to each other yet. So there's no reason for them to be in contact. The reason was to find the right mate, which they did, which is why they're engaged. But until they're married, they should not be really engaged. No, because what's the point of that? Some people hold that the point of that is you're building the foundation for your marriage. But care has to be taken during that engagement period because mistakes, big mistakes, can happen during engagement. You know, there's the Victorian saying that the first baby can come any time after the wedding and all subsequent babies take at least 9 months. So, and that's from the Victorian era. That. So you want to be careful during engagements because once you already know that there's going to be permission, it's very hard to stay apart. And thoughts can happen that are inappropriate. So even if a couple's not touching, even if they're not breaking that, certainly fantasizing can happen, which is not good for a male. That's where the spilling seed comes in for a male. Mm-hmm. And then he's just bringing it down to a straight physical level. So now he's begun the sexual engagement with his wife in fantasy before the wedding, which is not a healthy thing. Mm-hmm. So you definitely want to protect. There's so much protection that has to go on to create a strong bond and kedusha in a marriage that all these things come along to ban different things. So it's not just that a man is so weak, it's that marriage is so powerful. But it loses its power if you don't protect it. So this is about protecting marriage, it's about protecting Kedusha, it's about bringing Kedusha into the world, and it's about then banning different things to create protection and Kedusha, among other things. I'm not going to assume pastor or person say I understand this, but that's part of what's going on here. So you see, this is a very long mitzvah. Not to gaze at the colored clothing, not to inquire about the welfare of the wife, and not to, and even to set up extra fences for yourself if you find you need an extra one. So it could be that a young, let's say, yeshiva bachur of today might say, you know what, I can't take the public buses right now. It's not safe for me. You know, I see things I shouldn't be seeing, right? Or I can't go shopping in the supermarket and stand in the aisles with all the mag. I can't do that. You know, like I need that extra fence. So nowhere in the Torah does it say, don't shop at King Supers and walk through the checkout. It doesn't say that. But you might say to yourself, I can't handle it. It's not healthy for me. So I choose to make that a fence for myself. So that's 188, not to do anything that would cause pleasure in any way with somebody who's listed as an erva. Okay, now going to 189. The prohibition on uncovering the nakedness of one's father. So now we're going to go through a bunch of things. Now you would think that this would be covered in the prohibition of sleeping, lying carnally with another man, which is a separate prohibition. But this makes
Noah.
It two. Right, right. So we definitely have the story of Canaan, right? That was who did it? No, it's Ham, whose son is Canaan. Ham, who uncovered the nakedness of his father, right? So some people say he just looked at
but
him.
Noah slept with his daughters.
No, not Noah. Moab. Not Moab. That was the name of the kid. Lot.
Lot.
Mm-hmm. Noah's nakedness was uncovered. That's this week's parsha.
Yeah.
Right? So in this week's parsha, in chapter... nine.
He slept with his daughters because he felt that the world
well, the
was...
That's Lot.
Yeah, it was Lot.
Yeah.
Well, that was Lot.
That's Lot.
Right.
That's Lot.
Wow. Okay.
But Noah, after the ark landed, and after he goes out, and after he plants a vineyard, mm-hmm. he gets drunk. He's in his tent drunk. And apparently his nakedness is uncovered.
Okay. Okay.
Right. So the story that you learn in elementary school is Ham goes in, sees it, laughs. So his Avera is, you know, deriding his father that he's lying there naked, right? Whereas Shem and Yafet hear that when he exits the tent, and they're mortified that his father should not be honored appropriately, even sleeping alone in his tent. And so they take their cloak or their father's cloak, and they walk in backwards, so not to see him, and cover him.
Okay.
Okay. That's what you learn in elementary
Thank
school.
You.
However, what the actual story is, it seems to be, is that Ham went in there and castrated his father. Ham being the youngest and not wanting any more heirs. And so took the opportunity of his father's drunkenness to not just view the erva, but to do something to it. So which is why Canaan, his fourth son, Ham's fourth son, because Ham was number three, and prevented number four, right, by doing that. Mm-hmm. So Ham's fourth son was then cursed.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I never knew that.
Yeah. Uh-huh, is cursed.
It was Ham in general.
Ham himself.
Ham, right, and then his fourth son in specific, yeah, was cursed. So Ham in general is cursed. Right, so, and that's where we get, and I'm not saying that this is the case, and I don't understand it fully, and I really should write it down, something I should learn more about. But that's where certently the Christians got that blacks are cursed, and blacks are a slave people from that.
See, I never got that in Christianity, but
definitely yes.
That was part of their,
yeah.
They didn't want it to go on
there. Right, right. For sure they do.
Right.
I'll say it out loud. I don't mind at all.
Okay.
So the Mormons who did not permit blacks to convert to Mormonism or to become priests, I think they were allowed to convert, but they weren't allowed to be priests.
Yeah, they couldn't go through the chairs.
They couldn't there's different levels of priestliness that the Mormons have set up, and they wouldn't allow blacks to go through it. Because blacks are cursed.
Right.
So in the 70s, when they were being sued for racial discrimination within the church, it turns out that the top prophet of Mormonism, just at the time, right before they went to trial, had a revelation from God that they no longer are cursed. And they now can go through those steps.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really, that really helped, because then they didn't have to do the whole trial and everything. Cause, yeah, that worked out well.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ham,
mm-hmm.
Hot, Africa, hot. And his skin was darker. And it's interesting, if you look in the Amloes, it lists his different curses, which are all black. So it says, I mean, it goes through the list. So I don't know if that's cultural of the time because of an interpretation. I would like to learn more about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it does list it, and it does. So it doesn't say black skin. I'm not sure. But it does list other traits of thicker lips and a wider nose and curly hair and why each one of those things are a sign of curse. Wow. Yeah. So you can look that up in the Mamluays in the Torah anthology, which was written in Ladino in the 1700s in the Greek-Turkish area. But he lists through the different, so on that verse of Noah in this week's parsha.
Okay.
So it's interesting
Ham
to see.
Where
Ham is cursed. Yeah. Yeah. So it'll be chapter 9, somewhere in chapter 9.
Okay.
Which I know from my Rabbi Rieti training, right? 9 wine. He drank the wine. That's where he was cursed.
Right.
So, anyway.
Well, he was black to begin with, though, right?
It seems that way, that these three sons
because
were.
Because she had asked if that was part of the curse.
Didn't turn black, I don't think.
Right.
No. Well, but maybe. Maybe turned blacker. I'm not sure. That's what I'm saying. I don't know. I don't know all this. I just know that what it says in the Mamluays, which I don't know if that's influence or if that's straight from Chazal. I'm not quite sure where that's holding. But for sure, Ham was cursed. And when in dividing up the world, Ham, as those three nations, Rav Hirsch has a very interesting piece. If you want to take out your Hirsch Chumash and read about the three sons, it really talks about the three chunks of humanity. Shem, Ham, and Yafet, and who they are. So Ham does cover Africa and probably covers, like, let's say, South America and maybe North American Indians and tribal things. It's hotter. It's more passionate. The drum beating, the sexuality, the more animal nature of those tribes and types is a group of the world. And then you have Shem, which is the more intellectual, the Semitic groups. So even the Arabs are in that group. They have the more poetry, language, science, and stuff comes from there. And then Yafet, which is the Greek group, aesthetics. It's from Yofi, Yafet, as the aesthetics, the art, the drama and stuff comes from there. So that it is different chunks of humanity. So whether they represent specific nation archetypes or themes within nations, but we do see that nations fall under themes.
Mm-hmm.
And so Rav Hirsch discusses there's a whole long essay about themes of nationhood in the world from the descending from those three sons.
Hmm.
And goes into also some of the curse that comes to Ham through that and what that is. Okay, that being said, back to 189. I'm glad I didn't make a sheet today because I wasn't for sure how far to go. Okay, the prohibition of uncovering the nakedness of one father. So that's in addition to another male. So a father specifically. It says here at the bottom, the significance of this injunction is obvious. There's no need to write at length about its root reason, for it is fitting to remove this great ugliness from human beings and to punish transgressor for it. With a great penalty, he is therefore sentenced to death by stoning. So, however, if it's a mistake, it's hard to imagine how it could be a mistake. So death by stoning is the punishment for somebody who does it on purpose with warning and witnesses. So that means two people have to witness him about to have sex with his father. They have to say, hey, do you realize that if you have sex with your father, you will be culpable for death by stoning? And he has to say, yes, I realize that, and then do it in front of them. And that's when the death by stoning occurs. Let's say he did it on purpose in private. It's karet, right? It's still an avera, but it's not death by stoning. It's karet. Hashem takes care of it. Let's say, for whatever reason, I can't see how it's possible, but we do think about these things theoretically too. It was a mistake, right? So then he has to bring two, because it's two mistakes. One, sleeping with a male, and one, uncovering the nakedness of his father. Two separate averas. He has to bring two korban chatats for that. And when, halachically, does this mistake happen? When is it official? It's when the initial part of the male organ enters into the other male. Just the initial part. It doesn't have to be the whole thing. Just the tip. So that's when it becomes the actual avera has been committed. Okay, so that's 189. 190. The prohibition on uncovering one's mother's nakedness. So here there's a little bit more that we should look at, and we'll finish with this today. Okay, so that's As to the reason for the ban on consanguineous relations, Rambam of blessed memory wrote that in substance it is because the Torah would remove conjugal... Now, this is interesting to see. Would remove conjugal intimacy from human beings. It would remove it altogether, he's saying, the Torah would say, except for what is necessary for reproduction or for a religious duty. Therefore, the Torah prohibited near relations to us because it is... because one is the more likely to succumb to misfortune with them since they are about us constantly. So it's hard to figure this out, and it's hard to make this work with some of the other things that we've learned about conjugal intimacy and how strong it is and how the Torah wants it. But it's so risky, and it's certainly saying that with those who are about us constantly, there is a risk with, you know, people that you're very familiar with being around you constantly. So since one might succumb to misfortune, so what is the misfortune? Misfortune could be the weaker child, or misfortune could be the engaging in something that's only physical and not about creating a bond, so therefore there's an extra isor put there to protect. So that's what the Rambam says. However, the Ramban of blessed memory writes that this reason is very weak, that the writ should impose over these the penalty of karet merely on account of their being about one constantly. And on the other hand, it permits one man to marry 100 wives if he wishes, or even 1,000. So it couldn't be, it's just to permit superfluous sex. So he said that the reason is, according to what seems reasonable, that there's the matter of the mysteries of creation that is attached to the soul. And it's part of the general mystery of impregnation to which we have alluded previously. That's what the Rambam says. And that alluded to previously is the Ramban. Says that he alludes to his Shar Hagmul, where he uses the term mystery of impregnation, Sod Ha'ibur, in reference to the fact that children of closely related parents are frequently feeble-minded or otherwise defective. So that's part of the mystery of pregnancy, what happens in the pregnancy. So, of course, this is before they knew scientifically what's going on genetically, but they certainly knew in terms of practical reality that the results of these types of relationships came out weak. Thus far his words, the words of the Ramban. But now, going back to the Rambam of blessed memory, he wrote another reason as well about the matter, that by way of the plain meaning to his mind, so this works with the author of the Sefer Chinuch, he stated that the Torah imposes a barrier in order that a man should not be so arrogant as to be conjugally intimate with a woman whom properly he ought to treat with respect. And he strains to explain most of them in this vein, i.e. on account of the quality of shame as set forth in his work. But it would draw the subject out unduly if we undertook to write out the whole thing. So he's just alluding to the fact, and it would be interesting study to see, that the Rambam, in his Guide to the Perplexed, explains that relations with close female family members would breach the respect that's necessary for them. There's an article that I saw in the Smithsonian years ago, which I'd love to find, and I've tried looking online and haven't found it, but a whole article about the Wild West and the calming influence of women in the West. Mm-hmm. And it even quotes from some letters written home by men saying, we are so wild, we have no mothers or sisters or wives. We have no wives to settle us, no mothers to counsel us, no sisters to smoothen us, or whatever. He gave like a different word for each one of them, mm-hmm. that there weren't enough women to settle the men, which is why the West was so wild. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to think, about the influence, and that man was thinking about the influence of the... Right,
wild.
And that there was no woman to settle them down in the different ways. And it was interesting to see the different ways, mother, wife, and sister, in different functions, settle the men. So that you wouldn't want to take away that ability for that settling to happen by mixing up the relationships. There's a relationship of respect between sister and mother that has to be, and aunt that has to be respected. So among the laws of this precept is what the sages of blessed memory taught, that the ban on the mother holds even when she was another one's father's victim of compulsion. Because anyway, she's the mother. So it doesn't matter how. Because there is also a prohibition on your father's wife. So if it's your father's wife, which of course wouldn't be if it was a rape, but she's still your mother. But if it's your father's wife and your mother, then there's two prohibitions. If it's your father, if it's just your mother, but not your father's wife, meaning a rape, or just a, and even if it's a mamzer, even if it's not your father's wife, but he slept with somebody else, and it's not his wife, but it's still your mother, it's still forbidden. So, and there's all kinds of fences for that, too. And it goes straight back. Fathers, let's see, your mother goes back to all of the grandmothers on both sides, is included in that. It's interesting, is it in this one that it says? No. So we're going to get to where, in the future chapters, where it talks about how some of these apply to non-Jews as well. But, for instance, it doesn't go, but for non-Jews, it doesn't apply to all the generations going up and going down. It just usually applies to that one person. And for non-Jews, the penalty is different. For non-Jews, the penalty is death. You don't need witnesses and warning, but you do need testimony or admission before you can kill them for it. So either some kind of witness that two people can testify against, and it could be two non-Jews testifying, or the person has to admit that they did it, and which does not work in a Jewish court for Jews. Admission doesn't work. It has to be witnesses and warning. But for a non-Jew, death would be the penalty, but only for that one person, not for the extended. So we'll see.
Okay, it says something here on page 305, the secondary ones.
Right, so the secondary ones are the ones that are not the main prohibition. So if it says you cannot sleep with your mother, that's the primary.
But you can sleep with your aunt?
No, well, that's a separate one.
All right.
Mother is primary.
Yeah.
Grandmother is secondary.
Oh.
She's still your mother.
Okay.
Your mother's mother, your father's mother.
Great-grandmother.
And great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great. Okay. All of those, if you would ever see one of them alive, are forbidden.
Okay.
Because they're the secondary ones.
Okay.
The primary one is that actual mother. Okay. But her mother, or your father's mother, is the secondary inclusions in this.
Okay.
Right. So I think that's where we're going to have to end. Let's see what it does say. This is among the, we'll read that last paragraph in 190. This is among the forbidden consanguineous relations about which all mankind was generally commanded. However, there's a difference between the Israelites and the other nations in regard to the secondary ones. For the Israelites have erected a fence concerning the secondary ones, while among the other nations there is no ban on them but on a mother alone. Right. So it's not part of the Torah mitzvah for Jews, but it is part of the fence for Jews, all the secondary ones, which doesn't apply at all to the non-Jews. Okay. Ad Khan today. It's going to get very interesting as we go in further, because we're going to tackle the end. I hope that in the next two sessions we'll be able to finish this particular book, but we do have another. 209 is the prohibition of carnal relations with any male, and then there's also Nida, and prohibition of carnal relations with animals, all kinds of juicy stuff in here. So
just one thing, like when you go to Masharim in Israel, or I don't know, maybe in Williamsburg, I mean, the women are really pretty well covered up, totally.
Right.
I mean, they wear the dark stockings,
right.
And I mean, they're really taking that to the letter of the law, right? I mean,
letter of the law? No. Essence of the law, according to how they understand it today, yes.
Okay. And, I mean, what's...
Meaning there's no letter of the law that says you have to wear thick stockings.
No, but, I mean, you really have to be covered. There really isn't anything that is showing virtually, except maybe your hands and your face.
Right.
I mean, what's the difference between that and a burqa?
Right. Oh, there's a big difference between that and a burqa.
I know,
yeah.
But
there is a very big difference.
I know, but I mean, technically, you know, I mean, the woman really pretty much has to be almost totally covered, wig and clothes.
What is the next step? Because it's gone from what it was 40 years ago to that point. So what would be their next step?
No, you're wrong.
That would worry me.
That, I mean, it'll stay the way it
no.
is, but if there's...
No, I think that's a misunderstanding. Let's continue this conversation.
Okay.
But no, those people who have... If you're saying a next step, so there is not a next step.
Right, I know that.
And there are a few women in Israel today who are wearing veils and shawls, who are completely breaching the laws of tzniyus,
wow.
In my opinion.
Yeah, they're wearing face veils?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, not in Meisharim.
Okay.
It's a tiny little sect of mostly Baalot Tshuva,
uh-huh.
who are trying to be super frum and who are ruining it. So the veil has been banned by rabbis.
Yeah. Okay.
But there are people wearing shawls.
Mm-hmm.
So I did see one woman last year on the bus.
Now, what is the purpose of a shawl? Just more.
So imagine a poncho. Okay. It's called a shawl in Israel. The shawlim, plural, but imagine a poncho. Mm-hmm. So a poncho that's coming, let's say, just past one's derriere, right, and buttons here. Mm-hmm. So that just gives extra. More, it is a burqa.
Right.
It is a short burqa.
Okay.
That's what it is.
Okay.
So that even though you're completely tznius underneath, outside, they're thinking, why should you show your form at all to a man? Mm-hmm. So I saw a woman on the bus wearing a shawl on top, a tznius shawl, quote unquote. But she was holding on to the upper railing, you know, to steady herself. She's standing on the bus. Mm-hmm. So she had a safety pin here to keep it close. And I'm thinking, really? Really? You need a safety pin there? No, take that shawl off. In my opinion, it is anti-tznius. Because if you think about what tznius is, if tznius is to allow you to be primarily spiritual, and so to quiet the voice of the physical so that the spiritual is what stands out, that's what tznius is, to allow the spiritual to take the leading role. The physical is so noisy that you have to quiet it to allow that to happen. So then that's becoming overly physical, to wear a shawl and a face veil. It's just like wearing a bikini. Just like it. Because either end of the spectrum is being very physical.
Gotcha.
You've got to be in a place where the physical is quieted. So it's not about covering. It's not a burqa. And it is not about covering everything. That is not what it's about. It's about quieting the voice of the spirit, the physical, so that the spiritual can be heard. That's what it's about. So that's why I'm saying they are not adhering to the letter of the law, because there is no letter of the law that says you have to dress that way. There is a spirit of the law, and there are certain letters of the law. So a letter of the law is knees have to be covered all the time, sitting and standing.
And elbows. And
no.
Neckline.
No.
No?
No.
So that's minhag?
Yes.
Okay. Huh.
Yes.
Okay.
Where on the arm and where on the chest is subjective according to generation.
Okay.
So in today's generation, right now, at this point in the Haredi world, we're very close up with the necklines, closer than we were several years ago. Collarbones had to be, I mean, several years ago, what I learned was collarbones. Today, we're all that nice and tight. Nice and tight. So, it just, the shells have gotten much tighter. They have shell, you know, shells that you can wear under things. They've just got, the necks have gotten much tighter. And you see people with shells who put a safety pin in the back and to make it even tighter. So, so their necklines.
That's what I'm talking about, the next step somebody in Israel's already taken. Is it correct? I'm not saying it's correct.
It's not
I'm
a next step. I'm saying that's an error.
It's an error.
And nobody in Meir Sharim is
but
doing
I'm
that.
I'm just saying.
No.
We have seen an evolution.
No.
But I think it's
people who don't understand.
Yes.
I get that, but it doesn't mean that it has not filtered into those who are trying to find.
No, I disagree. I disagree. It is Baal Tshuva crazies who have taken that on, people who don't understand halacha. You don't see that in Meir Sharim, and people in Meir Sharim are dressing just the same today as they did 150 years ago. I mean, maybe slightly different patterns in their clothing, but they're dressing just the same.
What are the pictures at some of the girls' schools where 20 years ago...
20 years ago, they were breaking halacha. 20 years ago, 40 years ago, you see pictures in some of the girls' schools, who shall remain nameless, with some of the teachers standing there. So in the 1960s, the teachers were standing with shorts above their knees. Those teachers were breaking halacha at that time, wearing that skirt, because they transgressed into the non-Jewish world of fashion and wore what was being worn slightly longer than what was being worn in the 60s. But that is not halacha. We have gone through lax periods as a group where we wore lower things, higher things, whatever it was, but it doesn't mean that they were keeping halacha. So just because somebody today is a very respected Rebbetzin, and you see her picture in the 1960s wearing things that would never fly today, doesn't mean that what she was wearing in the 60s was according to halacha. It does not. So, and there are plenty of women in the 60s, from women who today, if they would be the same age today, for sure would be covering their hair. We're not covering their hair then. plenty of Frome women in certain neighborhoods who today cover their hair didn't for the first 20 years of their marriage and only started when their kids went into shidduchim. Mm-hmm. So, kids going into shidduchim or their hair thinning.
May you be correct. I just
see I'm correct. I'm nature. Telling you.
Well, I'm not yeah. saying no, that the it's halakha not... thing is not correct. I'm just saying what it seems to be.
It's not a swing. There is a swing to the right, but the tznius standards and tznius has objective and subjective aspects to it. So what I'm wearing today is tznius by objective stand by subject by objective standards and by subjective standards of today. However, if I would be in the 1880s, dressed exactly this way with everything covered according to halacha, I would absolutely be not tznius. That I'm wearing a skirt this length, that I don't have petticoats, that there's no hoop, that my ankles are showing. That's not part of tznius. But in the 1880s it is. In the 1880s I would not be permitted by halacha to walk the streets like this because I wouldn't be observing subjective tzniut of the time. Mm-hmm. So there is a subjective component and there is an objective component. Today, subjectively, a girl cannot wear, a Beis Yaakov girl cannot have a nose ring. But Rivka Imenu did in the Torah. It talks about Rivka having a nose ring. You walk into Beis Yaakov, you'll be chucked out with a nose ring. Right?
Sure.
But it is not objectively usser. It's subjectively not considered refined. Today, in 100 years, it might be fine. You don't see from men with their ears pierced. But if you look back at pictures of Jewish men in Greece 150 years ago, they... I have earrings in both ears. So if there's a subjective standard and an objective standard of the society, of the generation that plays in together. Yes, there's a movement to the right. But it's not that the next step is burkas. That's not it. The few Balchuvas who have made a mistake in Israel are incorrect in their interpretation of both subjective and objective standards of halacha and modesty. They're wrong. You don't see it in mainstream. You do not see it in mainstream from Judaism. You don't see it.
And may it never be so.
It won't be. Okay.